It's time to travel to the next room with Jane Asher, an exploration of the bigger picture surrounding life on Earth and what follows. Now, here's your host, Jane Asher, on Empower Radio.
It is always a good day when I wake up and I give thanks and I say, okay, here we go, another day. Another day for me to connect with just an extraordinary human being. Boy, I have to tell you a little backstory. The man I'm going to have on the show today, I'm in San Diego and he's in San Diego County. So I was reading the Union Tribune. Somebody had sent me an article about this man who had tragically lost his son. And I'm reading it and I'm sobbing while I'm reading this article, really well written in the UT. And I'm like, I have to have him on my show. I wonder if he would be willing to come on my show and talk to me. So, okay, put it aside because I've got all these guests, you know, piling in and I forgot about him. Flash forward, my buddy Jesse Brezendine, who I've had on the show, who's adorable. He's up in Santa Barbara. Jesse sends me an email and says, Jane, you have to meet Casey. Casey, you have to meet Jane. And so here we are. Casey is on my show today. Casey, is it Gaunt? Is that how you pronounce your last name?
Yes, that's correct.
All right. Casey Gaunt is here with me today. Boy, Casey, right before we got on the line, I thought, we're going to have to do another show because there's just too much to unpack in 30 minutes. So right off the bat, you need to come back on the show.
Be happy to.
All
Absolutely.
Right. Awesome. Casey's story is super complicated, but we're going to start with Suffering is the Only Honest Work. And that is his first book. It's a memoir of love, loss, and discovery. Casey's beautiful son, Jimmy, was tragically killed in an accident, hit by a car, and it forever obviously changed his life. And so he was a lawyer at the time, and through his book, he has really discovered quite a journey. So welcome to the show. I'm just so happy that you're here with me today, Casey.
Oh, Jane, thanks so much. I'm honored and privileged to be on your show and in the company of the many amazing and wonderful guests that you've had. So thank you.
Well, I'll tell you what, I devoured this book. And by the way, if you're listening right now, I'll put links to Suffering is the Only Honest Work and his second book, When the Veil Comes Down. I'll put links to both of them. So you can just click, boop, boop, go buy them. You need to because I had goosebumps throughout almost this entire book, and I have dog-eared the pages, which I never allow myself to do, but I had to with this because I was running out of little bookmarks. Just so much inside of this book. So let's talk a little bit about Jimmy and tell me a little bit about that so that we can get to the story of you and how you wrote this book.
Happy to. Jimmy was 24 when he was tragically killed. He was born in 1983. And I have to say, from almost the get-go, I always felt Jimmy was an old soul, that he'd been around this block a few times before. Because as I look back and remember talking to him as a two-year-old, a three-year-old, he was always older. He spoke as if he was older. And it also became very clear early on that he was lights out smart. He taught himself to read at 5 years old because he wanted to be able to read the baseball articles in the sports page in the UT. He was an avid fan of baseball, and then he started getting the baseball cards. And so he had this burning desire to be able to read. He pushed himself like that. I remember we went to his first parent-teacher conference when he was in first grade, and we were the ones who told his teacher, you have to watch out for Jimmy. He pushes himself too hard. So make sure he's having fun and not taking himself so seriously. But that's just how he was. It seemed like he had this inner motivation force that made him do as much as possible and accomplish as much as possible in a very short time, which he did.
Mm.
He was in a bilingual class in fourth, fifth, and sixth grade, and he actually gave the sixth grade commencement speech half in English and half in Spanish.
Wow.
He was fluent by the time he graduated sixth grade in Spanish.
Oh, my.
And then, but he was also, I mean, he was just a good kid. I mean, he was well-liked. He was a fantastic athlete. He was a star wide receiver on the Torrey Pines High School football team, which was a very prominent football program in San Diego. He was a track star, high jumper. He was a musician. He studied saxophone for 8 years with one of the best jazz saxophone players, a guy named Anthony Ortega, who lives in Encinitas. So by the time he graduated high school, he's a virtuoso saxophone player as well. But he had also started to write. And when he got to USC on a full ride trustee scholarship, by the
way,
impressive. Everything paid for. Everything paid for. He started majoring in Spanish, but then he added a major English literature, and he began to write, and he began to write plays. He wrote three plays during college, two of which were put on by the USC Theater Department. Then he went to the Queen's College in London for his senior year, where he studied acting and English literature, and he wrote another play while he was there. And then after graduation, he moved to back to Hollywood, Los Angeles, where he was in the middle of pursuing a career as a professional writer. He ghostwrote a screenplay with a buddy of his for a major Hollywood director. When he came home on his last visit to us, before we lost him, he had just finished the fifth draft of this screenplay he'd been working on called Now's the Time. So, and he was studying acting. He was doing comedy with friends of his. So, I mean, he was just on fire. And he was so intellectually curious. And he was so outgoing with people that he just met. He had this ability to connect instantly and deeply with people because he was so curious about them and their stories and what motivated them. So he was extraordinary, to say the least.
Wow. You know, I'm listening to you, and it's almost like he had this inner knowledge that his life was going to be short, and he just was packing it all in almost.
It really seemed that way looking back, and my wife Hillary remembers Jimmy saying some things within the year before he passed. I mean, he was always, as I mentioned, just driving himself, you know, gotta do this, gotta do that,
right.
Time's short. And like, about a month before he died, he said to Hillary, he said, "You know what? It's odd. I just don't feel stressed anymore. I just feel like things are really calming down for me." And the week after he died, he was supposed to be on a sea kayaking trip in Vietnam and Cambodia. He was going to go with this major talent executive with Endeavor, who was mentoring him, and some other guys in the business. And he told Hillary, I think the week before, he said, "You know, Mom, I got this funny feeling. I just don't think I'm going to be on that trip."
Holy smokes!
Yeah, yeah,
it's amazing. I mean, when I got to the rabbit hole, which is one of the chapters. You said, "After Jimmy's death, I wondered if it would ever expand to fullness again. Everything I'd ever believed believed in seemed to have been rewritten in some strange language that could only be deciphered by a native inhabitant of this world of pain. Ugh. Yeah. More tears. I mean, wow. Okay, so Jimmy's 24. You go through this incredible experience that no one should have to go through, although so many people do on the planet. Let's talk about what happened and what brought you to actually writing this book.
Well, this Jimmy's death wasn't the first blow that I had received. And in 1970, when I was 20 years old, my father, the strongest man I knew, died by suicide. Mm. And his death, his choice, was absolutely devastating, not only to me, but my entire family. And the way I dealt with my father's death was to bury it, to bury his memory, because I was so angry with him.
Sure.
I was so hurt by him, and I was so frightened by the choice he made, you know, asking myself at the time, I'm a 20-year-old, and I'm thinking, how could he do it?
Mm-hmm.
How could he do it? Could I do that? I mean, if things got to that point, is that the choice I would make? And so you've got all these horrible thoughts running through your head. So what I did, I never got any mental health help after my dad's suicide. So I just buried it. And so did my family. We kind of supported that. So when Jimmy died, I not only had to deal with his death, but I was now confronted with my father's. It all came rushing back. I now had two men that I had to grieve and deal with their two early deaths. And so I began to see a psychologist 6 weeks after Jimmy's death. And it was one of the smartest moves I ever made. And I call it Tuesdays with Dr. A, like Tuesdays with Maury. But the first thing he said to me after our first session, he said, Casey, we are not going to be able to deal with Jimmy's death until we deal with your dad's. Wow. We've got a lot of work to do here. So, so we started in. But what really flipped the page for me happened 6 weeks after Jimmy died. It was 3 months after Jimmy died. We're in November of 2008. I got a call from a woman from Colwood, West Virginia, who said, you know, we were together in Colwood 40 years ago, and you left something behind, and I want to get it to you. I go, what the hell is she talking about? After I graduated from high school in the Chicago area in 1968, I went to Colwood, West Virginia, and worked on a construction project that summer in the coal mines. My family's construction business based in Chicago had this job in Colwood to dig this big ventilation shaft for a new section of the coal mines.
You grew up in that shaft. That's a good chapter.
I grew up in that shaft. Exactly. And so I spent the summer there, and I remember meeting this Emily Sue Buckberry, who was 8 years older. And for those of you who ever read the book Rocket Boys or have seen the movie October Sky, starring Chris Cooper and Jake Gyllenhaal, that's where it all takes place, in Colwood, West Virginia, where I spent that summer. Homer Hickam, who wrote the book and became the town's hero because his memoir was turned into this movie, that's where he grew up. So anyway, I leave Colwood at the end of the summer. You know, I go to USC college, you know, law school, get married, have kids. And now it's 40 years later, and this woman's calling me and telling me she's got something I left behind.
Oh, my.
So I talk to her, And she said, yeah, when you left, I wanted to come say goodbye, but you had already gone. And I went by your room and I saw outside your room, there was a waste paper basket and there was a letter outside of an envelope on the floor. So I picked it up. I looked at it. I read a few lines. I realize it's a letter from your father to you. And I figured, oh my gosh, this is an important letter. Why did Casey, it was marked personal and confidential. Why did Casey throw it away? I'm going to keep it. I'm going to try and get it back to him. 40 years later, she now Googles me and tries to find me and does.
Wow.
She sends me the letter. And again, I'm really early on in trying to deal with my father. I'm not sure I even want something from him. Okay. I'd spent 40 years just putting him, or 38 years, because my father died by suicide in 1970, which was 2 years after my experience in colon. So anyway, letter comes on a Saturday, and we had been at the beach all day. My daughter Brittany and I went out on boogie boards, and we took some of Jimmy's ashes and we spread them outside the surf line. It was just a gorgeous day. I come back and the letter or the package from Emily Buckberry's in the mailbox. So I open it up, start reading the letter. It's 2 full pages, front and back, written in my dad's very precise, neat handwriting.
Mm.
And it's like, first thing I realized is I had never read the letter before.
Hmm.
I knew it right because this is a letter that I would never have forgotten based on what he was telling me, because he was confessing to me the problems he had in his life, that he suffered a depression in his youth, that he had a religious fanatical mother he couldn't deal with, that he suffered mightily during World War II, where we spent 2 years in the South Pacific fighting in some of the most horrible battles there were as a young major in the Army, leading a battalion of men to their deaths or trying to keep them alive. I mean, the things that he... So he's sharing this with me, and he's saying, I'm not sure I was successful. Others will have to judge me. But you,
wow,
my son, you've got all the tools to do whatever you want to do. You control your destiny.
Oh, my goodness.
And you know, you're smart, you're good looking, and I just want the best for you. And he's, keep in mind, he's writing this two years right before he died. But I feel he's in the room with me. I feel we're having a father-son conversation.
Yeah, he was.
And then he closes the letter with this. I'll be around anytime you want me. I'll be there. Because I care more than you ever know.
Oh, my God.
My son. All along.
Wow.
What I didn't mention is that the day that letter arrived,
pretty significant,
that Saturday, November 8, 2008, that was Jimmy's 25th birthday.
Oh, goosebumps.
My dad knew that was going to be the hardest day of my life.
Yeah.
And he was there with me.
And he used,
because he promised he would be. 40 years later, the promise he made 40 years earlier, he was there.
That is not a coincidence. That is your dad reaching out and wrapping his arms around his little boy on a day that you needed him the most.
Right.
Oh, that's just extraordinary. Wow.
It changed everything for me, Jane.
Yeah.
It changed everything. It changed how I viewed life, how I view death, how I viewed my dad, you know.
Sure.
Instead of running from him, I began running towards him. I wanted to find him. I wanted to thank him. And I really took a deep dive into his life and, you know, what he went through and what he had to go through in the war and all of those things. And our family began to talk about him again. We brought him out of the darkness and into the light.
Good.
And so, and then I know Jimmy was involved in that too. His fingerprints were on that letter as well.
Heck
and
yeah.
Yeah. And so, so that was really the first story I wrote. That wasn't a legal contract. I mean, that really opened the door for me to start writing. And I knew that story, Jane, was not meant just for me.
Yeah.
It was meant to be shared.
Mm-hmm.
And it just was so, and it was a way for me to connect with others that I had not, like all my high, when my dad died, I cut off all contact with my high school friends, all my childhood friends, because they were linked, you see, to his memory.
Sure.
So I had to cut that off. But, you know, I began to share his story. I reconnected with all these friends from my childhood, you know, and I was building my tribe of people that, you know, were close to me. And as I discovered, were still very close to me.
Yeah.
Those, you know, they were still my friends.
Yeah.
But they didn't know, you know, what to do or what to say, but they were there for me. So, yeah. And then Jimmy started to work, you know, and he started to do all of his things, sending us signs and messages.
Isn't it? It's just amazing to me because all we need to do is just open up to receive. But a lot of times things are right in front of us, but it's our grief that maybe shuts that door. So good for you for being open and having your anger over your father's choice of leaving the planet dissolve into love.
Yeah.
That's beautiful.
Exactly.
So talk to me about Jimmy connecting with you.
The first thing he did, other than again, his letter, but, my dad's letter, it was probably a month after I received the letter from my dad that we being my wife, Hillary, daughter, Brittany, and I, we called ourselves Team Healing. We did everything together. We saw our first medium.
Good.
And that was the first of many, many readings that we've had over the years. But Jimmy came through very strong during that first reading. In fact, the first thing that, you know, once we sat down, the medium grabbed Hillary's hands. Her name was Tara from Sedona. And she said, oh, my gosh, my poor dear, you've lost a child. His name was James or Jimmy. And she goes, yes. And Tara starts laughing. She goes, oh, my God, that explains it. This kid has been barging into my readings for the last 3 days. He is so excited. And he says, Dad, I can't believe you're here.
Oh, that's
great.
I mean,
that's really cool. So,
wow.
He just was dropping all of these.
Jimmyisms?
Jimmyisms. You know, he's kidding Brittany, who had been married for a year. And he tells Brittany, he goes, Brittany, I'm not a pervert. I'm not watching you and Ryan make love. So, you know, don't just put that out of your head. And Brittany starts laughing hysterically. She admits, I've kind of been worried if they might be, you know. So it's just, I mean, he was exhibiting his sense of humor.
He was showing you it was him.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And he asked me, he says, Dad, where's the watch I gave you?
Oh, man.
And he had left behind this Rolex watch that his mentor that I had mentioned in Hollywood had given him after they ran the 2007 Los Angeles Marathon. And, I'm wearing this clunky Casio and Jimmy wants to know, I gave you the Rolex.
Yeah.
So why aren't you wearing it? You know, so just showing us. Right. It would have been 5 months later. Hillary and I took a trip with some really good friends to Paris and Belgium. And it was a trip that we were supposed to go on, like a month or two after Jimmy died, but we just couldn't go. There was just no way we were physically able. But anyway, we're in Paris. My sister, who lives in Switzerland, meets us in Paris. We had just landed that morning, and we decide to go grab some lunch. We're on the Ile de Saint-Louis, and we walk down to the Saint-Germain-des-Prés. There's a restaurant there, Les Deux Magots, and there's our friends, Bill and Terry, my sister, and Hillary. And I'm kind of in the middle, and we're all seated five across, looking across at the Saint-Germain-des-Prés, which is the oldest cathedral in Paris, a place where Jimmy and Brittany and Hillary and I had visited probably 10 years earlier or 15 years earlier when they were kids. So I'm turned to the left, looking at my friends, talking to my friends, Bill and Terry, when I feel Hillary grab my thigh, she's crushing me with the grip. I turn to look at her, and she's got tears rolling down her face. I look at my sister. She's got tears rolling down her face. I go, what happened? And Hillary said, I saw Jimmy walk right in front of the cafe. And I look at Laura. She nods her head. She goes, it was him.
Oh, my God.
He walked right by. And so that was one of his first physical appearances. But then what he, because Jimmy was the writer and the playwright, he had the ability to create these very complicated synchronicities involving not just us, but friends of his and colleagues of his. And as we share some of those, and Suffering is the Only Honest Work, like Want to Go for a Ride, like the Ghost Rider, like the Rabbit Hole Letters. I mean, Jimmy creates these, they're like plays.
Sure.
They really are like movies. And he just recruits his friends and family to be the characters and then brings everybody together. And then everybody's looking at each other like, what just happened? What just happened?
It's incredible.
You know, and so, again, so I started writing those down and sharing those. And then all these stories that I'm just sharing with family and friends, it's getting unwieldy. So I start a website in 2011, just as writemesomethingbeautiful.com is a place where I can share these things.
Mm-hmm.
And then more and more is happening. And then others are sharing their stories with me. And so that's really why Suffering is the Only Honest Work came together in 2015, because I realized just going to the website and trying to wind your way through these stories is going to be pretty difficult. So I wanted to pull them together, pull the key stories together, and have something where if somebody wanted to really get to the essence of our story, they could find that in the book.
It's so good, Casey. It's such a great book. I mean, I sat, I couldn't put it down, and then I picked up your next book. So it's called Suffering is the Only Honest Work. WriteMeSomethingBeautiful.com is where you can connect with Casey. Casey, I'm like, what the heck? I need an hour to even get started with this, because I wanted to talk to you about the fraternity and Jimmy's legacy and all of that. So I'm just going to have you back on, and we'll do another show, and we'll get to all of this, because through your loss, you have created such a beautiful community of men that get together that have all lost a child. And of course, men, you know, you come on the planet, don't cry, be tough, provide for your families, you know, don't show emotion. And gall darn it, you got all these men to gather and to start talking about their great loss when they have, I can't even fathom. So just beautiful, beautiful work. And I'm so very proud of you for doing this and for pivoting. You know, you no longer practice law, correct?
Correct. That's
and
correct, yeah.
Look at
full
you
time.
Go.
Full-time on this new gig.
Good
yeah.
for you. Casey. Yeah. Casey Gaunt, When the Veil Comes Down is book number two. Suffering is the Only Honest Work. I will put links to everything on the show page. And Casey, I'm going to have you back on because we really need to talk more deeply about not just your relationship and your discovery with Jimmy, but also about your wife and your beautiful daughter and the team that you have with your son-in-law. And now you have beautiful grandkids. And Jimmy's very much part of all of it. He's yes. with you just in a different form.
That's totally correct. Absolutely. Yeah.
I love this line from Suffering. It says, "I'd hit bottom in the shaft of desolation. And that is when my portal opened." So you fell to your lowest level, and that is when you opened up to receive. Casey Gaunt, my guest today on The Next Room, When the Veil Comes Down, his most recent book, and Suffering is the Only Honest Work. Please do yourself a favor and pick these up, especially if you know of anyone, which I have several friends, I'm sorry to say, that have lost a child. It's really unfathomable, but suffering will give you hope and also maybe open your portal to connection, which I love that you've done. Any final thoughts for us, Casey, before we close for today?
No, I would say, I love your show's title, The Next Room, and I hope that when it's my turn to transition, that I'll find that there really isn't a next room. We're all in the same room, and we always have been, and we always will be. And so I'm going to continue to chase that and share what I find. And just thank you, Jane, so much for having me on, and I look forward to continuing our conversation.
I love it. Thank you so much. WriteMeSomethingBeautiful.com. Casey Gaunt, my guest today. Casey, and I do want to say Jimmy has been here the whole time. So,
of course, yes.
There you go. Casey and Jimmy Gaunt on The Next Room today, and WriteMeSomethingBeautiful.com. Thank you so much, Casey, for coming on the show. And like I said, we'll get you scheduled to come right back on and also rope you into the Beautiful Dying Expo, which I think that you really will be a lovely addition to have you come on board and be part of that beautiful event that's coming up in November.
Thank you, Jane. I'd love to.
Awesome.
Be my pleasure.
Thanks so much for tuning in to The Next Room. I will catch you next Monday on The Next Room.
Join Jane again next week for The Next Room on Empower Radio as she examines the beliefs, traditions, and personal evidence of connection with those who have moved on to the next room.